Medical Breakthroughs, the research journey. Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Caroline Burden, and you're about to join me on a journey into the fascinating world of medical breakthroughs. But not just any breakthroughs. We're diving into the personal stories, the setbacks, the you will not believe this moments behind the cutting edge research happening right here at Leeds Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust. Coming up in this episode.
Women in certain cultures, they may not feel empowered to ask a man to donate a kidney. We see commonly in a woman who's not economically active, who's uneducated, they don't feel empowered to ask a kidney from somebody who's working and economically active. We also see parents in certain cultures not comfortable asking their children.
So when people aren't making the most health positive choices, you have to ask yourself why. And that's what this research project is all about.
My name is Sunil Dagger. I'm a consultant nephrologist, and I'm also the living kidney donor lead for Leeds Teaching Hospital. Kidney disease is a silent disease. Often individuals don't get any symptoms until the kidney function drops below 10%. And that's the nature of the disease, I'm afraid. And what's also shocking is the condition that causes kidney disease are also silent. So, for example, diabetes, high blood pressure, or obesity. We know at the moment about 1 in 10 individuals over age of 35 have moderate to severe amount of kidney damage.
That's shocking. 1 in 10, and it's moderate to severe.
That's correct. And the way we define moderate kidney disease is anything less than 60% of kidney function. So that's the reality we're facing, I'm afraid, and that's only going to double in the next 10 years because of all the other health issues increasing in prevalence in the society.
And I was reading, I think it was a paper perhaps that you'd written with the predictions in it for the future and the number of times you were expecting that to increase in the next 10 years. Was it 400%?
That's correct, and that number comes from research undertaken by one of the largest research charity in the UK called Kidney Research UK. And that prediction model is 400% increase in demand of dialysis, which affects severely on individuals' lives, but also puts a lot of pressure on healthcare systems. So we are staring at a 400% increase demand of dialysis in the next 10 years.
And in practical terms for patients, what does dialysis look like? I mean, on its most basic level, you're hooked up to a machine, but how often are patients having to come in? How long are they hooked up for?
Well, the key thing is dialysis is a life-saving treatment, and often it's a bridge before somebody gets a kidney transplant. Dialysis is extremely demanding on an individual's life, really. They have to come to a hospital every other day. They need to have the treatment for 4 hours. And if you put together the travel time, it's generally 6 to 7 hours of that time every other day. And that's the most prevalent way of doing dialysis, is to coming to hospital. Now, a small proportion of individuals can also do dialysis at home, but that's a very small proportion. So majority of individuals, I'm afraid, will be spending time in hospital for this life-saving treatment until they get a kidney transplant. Now, they don't have to do dialysis. This is really important to know, because often people say to me, well, transplant is a last resort, isn't it, when the dialysis is not going good? Well, actually, that's not true. The truth is, if you are fit for transplantation, a kidney transplantation should be the first choice, the first treatment somebody with kidney disease gets. But unfortunately, only 5% or 10% at the max individuals would get a kidney transplant even before they need dialysis. So about 90% of individuals in the UK will, I'm afraid, end up on dialysis. And a fair proportion of those individuals could have been avoided if a timely process was followed, a timely support was given to these patients, then they could have avoided the dialysis treatment.
And why is that timely support not being received at the moment?
It's a variety of reasons, really. Some of them is patient factors. Some of them is the system factor. So when somebody, from not knowing about kidney disease to really understand what kidney disease is, to understand that the kidneys are packing Often individuals would be thinking more or less about dialysis, and I'm afraid the healthcare providers also try to support what is their thinking and what their choices are. When it comes to kidney transplant, there are two broad ways one can get an organ. One would be through the national waiting list. So this is after somebody dies and they donate an organ. And often patients would choose that because they don't want their loved one to go through a major operation. For a loved one to donate one of the kidney, they have to go through a number of stringent tests. A lot of individuals would be uncomfortable to take that as the first choice. And I think that's one of the major reasons, to be honest. The second reason is about 1 in 4 individuals start dialysis, not even known to renal service. So there is a delay in referring to secondary care. There is a delay in presenting to the kidney service. So we don't really have time to prepare them for transplant, because often the biggest thing in front of us is their safety. And the dialysis is, of course, a life-saving treatment. So those are the two major things that dictates what actually happens, whether it's dialysis or transplant. Now, in an ideal world, the individuals with kidney failure or at risk of kidney failure should be in the services in well advanced. So they have understood what the kidney disease means. They had enough time to consider various options, and most importantly, to start thinking about kidney transplantation. That's what an ideal world would be. The second thing about supporting those complex conversation and complex decision making is, at the moment, the resources we have in NHS is very much what you would describe as one fit model, whereas we know we look after diverse individuals, not only diversity in race or ethnicity, but also diversity in needs of health literacy, how they can understand and process information, you know, the language needs, but also, you know, a group of individuals may have barriers on the culture and the cultural norms, or faith might be important. So when it comes to a transplantation where you accept an organ from other humans, you could see there is a range of things that comes into that decision, as compared to, for example, having an appendix taken out, which becomes just a little easier decision making, isn't it?
And this is where your research lies at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So again, you know, the research is done by a multidisciplinary team. We really wanted to have diverse views, the researchers who directly care for the patients. And also we observe that if the patient is looked after by a transplanting center like Leeds, they do better as compared to, for example, patients looked after in a referral center. What I mean by referral center means this is another kidney centers where they don't perform kidney transplant. So the current research we are doing is actually working with colleagues in Bradford Renal Unit. So this is one of our referral center for Leeds Teaching Hospital. We work with psychologists, qualitative researchers to understand those, to explore those decision-making needs. And we had, you know, support from two major charities of our region, the Leeds Hospital Charity, as well as Kidney Research Yorkshire, to enable us to work that multidisciplinary team to support a researcher who then actually went out and undertook a number of interviews of both staff and the patients who have gone through this journey of decision making. And that's where this research becomes really important, because so far within UK, nobody has taken that deep dive in to understand both a transplanting center, a referral center, and all the people who are involved in the decision making. What we really wanted to do was, this research resembles our clinic patients. Often when research happens, the research can be of convenience, where they go and recruit patients that are easy to recruit. Yeah. Often there are barriers in recruitment for research as well, on top of, you know, the barriers I mentioned about decision-making. When it comes to research, those barriers, I'm afraid, compounds and can be even more challenging as compared to the clinical environment.
Presumably that's because it's much easier to approach people who speak the same language as you and who, you know, are affluent enough to perhaps have time in order to be able to dedicate to this, which is a privilege in itself.
Well, absolutely, because for certain groups of individuals, when you talk about research, it's very different than when you talk about clinical treatment in a clinic, really, because suddenly the trust becomes a major issue. You know, sometimes patients read stories about how some individuals are guinea pig and how the research was conducted, etc. So trust becomes a really important thing, and as you quite rightly said, able to relate to the researchers and able to communicate and build that rapport is it takes even more time than actually in a clinic environment where they know that they're going to see a doctor or a nurse and they're going to talk about this. Whereas research, in its own sense, it's a little bit more than the clinic, isn't it? You need to know the personal perspective. You want to know about the cultural norms, the faith, the various dynamic. Said it is different than what a clinical consultation would be. And thankfully, only a couple of people who we approached actually declined, because what we really have is a diverse group of individuals within the research team who can speak multiple languages, who understand the cultural norms, and who already have had rapport with these patients. So all of those played in our favor, thankfully, but you can see how sometimes that can be really hard if all of those are not there to facilitate a research of this kind.
I don't think I've ever really thought before about how biased research can be, because if you can only speak to the people that you are able to converse with, then obviously that's going to be skewed from the get-go.
Yeah, that's one of our major problem, really, because the research patients look very different than the patients we care in the clinic.
Yeah.
Often the research, as you quite rightly said, will be affluent people who are already engaged in their health, who are already doing great. And then to test a medicine, for example, whose outcome is always going to be good, then that results, you can't apply to the wide range of individuals you see, who has a number of different barriers, you know, whether from economic barriers, you know, able to come to the clinic in the timely way, able to take medicine, able to look after themselves, other health beliefs, you know, other things. So I'm afraid research at the moment doesn't reflect the patients group that we serve, doesn't represent the clinic. And hence it comes back to the researcher to try really, really hard as best as they can to resemble the research as clinic. And that's, I think, the biggest challenge. And I'm really proud that in our multidisciplinary research group, we were able to get there. We got a third of individuals in this research who does not speak any English. We got a third of individuals who come from socially deprived areas, as we call. And the other thing I really wanted to happen was there was a equal representation on the sex of the individual. So we wanted to make sure 50% of the participants are women, because they are also underrepresented in research, and more so in the kidney side of research, to be honest.
And in terms of what you've learned from the research, what does the care look like that people really genuinely need compared to the care that they're currently receiving? What are the differences?
Yeah, so I'll answer this by reflecting on two major groups of individuals that we interviewed. The first group of individuals were healthcare workers who are providing the support in the patient's journey. And that study showed, just like you described, they don't have those skill set to actually support everybody that comes to the door. They are able to support, if I want to stereotype, typical white, middle-class, male, affluent person, but they do struggle in terms of supporting, despite of their best intention. They just don't have the skill set, whether it's a cultural awareness, whether it's a faith awareness, whether the language barriers, So those are our low-lying fruit in a way, is to actually embed or learn a little bit more about cultural nuances in the group of patients that we see, you know, using staff who already understands those cultural norms or have a specific role where individuals of those needs could be supported. You know, for example, understanding the faith needs and involving that trust chaplain, for example, those things came as a real need from the healthcare worker. They also wanted their resources that they give out. For example, at the moment, for somebody who is waiting for kidney transplant, the video is 1 hour long video and all in English language. They're really trying to get that dubbed in different languages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's say our second biggest population speaks Urdu or Punjabi. So they are trying to translate that. So those were the needs that we got through the healthcare worker perspective. We then went on to talk to these diverse, underserved groups of individuals. Now, the patients that we interviewed had three different outcomes. A third of the patients were successful to get a living kidney donor. A third of the patient waited and were successful to get a kidney from a deceased person. And a third of the patient was still waiting. Now, because it's such a different outcomes and such a heterogeneous group of individuals, we don't have one fit model, which we were not expecting. What we know is we need to tailor the information. And one of the things we are thinking about is having a video resource in different language that is culturally adapted. That's one of the way to do it. The second thing we have done as a result of this research is to have an evening conversation. So when the family can come with the patients who's waiting for a kidney transplant, and we had an open conversation on a, you know, a sandwich and a tea, and that actually helped them as well. So getting outside the clinic setting, clinic norms, to sort of build that rapport and have that conversation. So those two things are our main sort of working, but I think we would need to go for individual person. We may have to empower them to, for example, to ask for somebody to come forward to donate a kidney, because at the moment, the healthcare worker can't go and knock the door of the friends and family. It comes back to the patient to take that initiative and the patient then to signpost those individuals who may be willing to donate a kidney, to signpost to us. So you could see there is already a barrier that the healthcare worker aren't able to easily overcome. But what we're trying to do is to support the patients who needs a kidney transplant, to empower them to really, I mean, this involves anything from coaching to mentoring. So quite a different approach than what you would expect in a clinical environment, you know, interaction with the patients and a healthcare worker.
And so is the goal to be able to have that more individualized care?
Well, absolutely. That is the goal. I think we would have to take some baby steps first, because the diversity and the needs of different groups are quite different. So we're going to go with our biggest group first. So, you know, within, for example, within white Caucasian, we're going to be focusing on health literacy, lower socioeconomic status, how we support them, and then thinking about non-English language or ethnic minority, we'll be thinking about, you know, providing a video that's focused on the cultural norms, the faith aspect, and also the linguistic aspects. So you're absolutely right. It is going to be a tailored approach that I'm afraid we will not be able to help everybody straight away, but it will be incremental, helping, you know, the biggest group and the biggest group that way.
And when you talk about you know, how culture plays a role in this, what do you see practically? What are the learnings on a practical sense?
So one of the things we see is women in certain cultures may be less empowered. They may not feel empowered to ask, for example, a man to donate a kidney. We see that as a culture of silence. The culture is about just tolerating, just coping with the disease, but not to us. I mean, we see this commonly in a underserved woman who's not economically active, who's uneducated. They don't feel that power tactics or power dynamic. They don't feel empowered to actually, for example, ask a kidney from somebody who's working and economically active. Mm-hmm. That's just an example. We also see parents in certain cultures not comfortable asking their children to donate a kidney. It becomes even interestingly. So, for example, Hindu faith, they would not want a kidney from the daughters because they feel that the daughter is a gift that they need to donate to the husband in total entirety, and not, you know, taking a kidney out of the daughter.
Yeah.
So those are certain cultural aspects. Yeah.
That's really interesting, because unless you address those, you're never going to see a difference in outcome.
Yeah, well, the first thing is to understand that those exist and to support them, and that, you know, this is safe because, you know, we will not allow anybody to donate a living kidney. They have to go through a stringent test. So one of the emphasis we're doing is that education, that, you know, giving them that reassurance that the living kidney donation is going for 70 years, you know, 7 decades. We learned a lot. And as a result, we know who can safely donate this kidney and live a healthy life. So those things are really important from the education aspect. And then the culture one, I think, will come around by, you know, having, for example, a role model. So we have patients and peer support who have gone through the similar things. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's almost like, you know, getting them those together, particularly the peers who are from the same culture, same religion, who could have a chat and have a conversation sort of, you know, outside the NHS. So we do use other charities, we use other patient groups, and we try and match those peers with a patient based on those characteristics, really.
It's genuinely fascinating, the work that you're doing. And just from listening to you, it's very easy to see the difference that this research will make.
Absolutely. We really have just only started to understand what is required. And we now actually started to focus on, you know, low-lying fruits, but also focusing on developing more resources. So the individuals are coming to Leeds or around the referral centres are supported as well as we can. What we need to do really is all of this in a timely way. As I said, only 5 to 10% of individuals actually start with a transplant. A lot of these individuals will start with dialysis. If you look at all the kidney transplant that happens in Leeds, 1 in 3 comes from living kidney donation. And about 50% of them is after they've started dialysis. So we are, you know, informing our healthcare worker, our processes through this research. If we can support them early and can translate those opportunities into a kidney transplant before the need of dialysis, then that is really good for individuals with kidney failure, but also really good for their you know, health economy. Now you'll be thinking, well, why would dialysis be an issue? You know, what is the price you pay if you are stuck on dialysis and you wait for a transplant? Well, what we know is a dialysis is as good as 15 to 20% of your kidney. The dialysis machine is only working 4 hours every other day, whereas a kidney is working 24/7. Usually after kidney transplant, you get about 30 to 40% of your kidney function. And if you're lucky, you can get about 50% of the kidney function. So dialysis is a life-saving treatment, but it has its own limitation. The limitation being that the toxin levels are still high in this individual. And that's what causes damage to their heart, damage to their blood vessels. And we see a lot of people on dialysis as a result suffer with heart attack and stroke, and they become no longer fit. So you might be fit before you start dialysis, but I'm afraid the risk of heart attack and stroke increases on dialysis. Hence, if you have a kidney transplant before the need of dialysis, that is the best case scenario.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid often individuals because of various concerns, they will choose dialysis and only think about asking a living kidney donation when things aren't going right.
And then it can be too late.
You don't have to wait for things not to go right. What we need to try and do is to get things right at the very beginning.
And can anyone apply to be a living kidney donor? Is there like a register? How does it work?
No, there is no register for a living kidney donation. If anybody is interested to donate a kidney, either to somebody that they know, or some individuals actually come to NHS and say they want to donate a kidney to a stranger. So in UK, about 1 in 10 living kidney donors actually donate kidney to a stranger. So the way to go about would be to approach the living donor team at the transplant center to express the interest that you are keen to donate a kidney, either somebody that you know or to strangers. There is no national register for this sort of thing, so I'm afraid. It is about approaching the clinical team, who then sends a health questionnaire, which is usually like a triage. You know, they ask various questions. And sometimes, you know, just through the questions, it becomes clear that this individual can't donate kidney, so then we don't put them through various tests. And once they pass the question stage, they are then invited to come to the transplant center where we, you know, assess them, where we put them through the test, and that's when we know if they could donate kidney or they need to look after themselves more.
And so what does the future look like in terms of the next level of research?
Yeah, so I think the biggest challenge next is we now know what this group of individuals would help. We now need to do further research to actually show that those are effective.
Yeah.
Because often, as you say, research leads to more research. and that very much applies to this particular piece of research. So we've done the first stage, we understand. Now we need to try and find things that actually makes difference, things that actually are going to get a person from A to B. And in this instance, increasing in living kidney donor transplantation. More to come is what I would say.
And that's about all we've got time for on this episode. But if you would like to find out more, you can find the details in our show notes. Medical Breakthroughs: The Research Journey is an Under the Mast audio production.